Let's call the meeting to order. This is the Energy Utilities Technology and Communications Committee. We have a pretty full agenda today. First of all, most of these bills will be passed, I think all of them will actually, if we pass them, will be passed to the Finance Committee. And their intended route is really to move into the stimulus package or the stimulus bill that we passed about a week ago. So, first of all, I would like an overview of weatherization, and I've asked Janet Streff to come and start off that presentation. Janet.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair.
Ms. Streff.
Members of the committee. My name is Janet Streff. I'm Director of the State Energy Office and the Office of Energy Security in the Minnesota Department of Commerce. As Director of the State Energy Office, I have oversight over the weatherization program, and wanted to spend just a couple minutes with you to tell you what happens at the state level in getting the money and training down to the agencies that actually carry out the work. But first, if you don't know yet, we do have official numbers and guidance from the U.S. Department of Energy on two of the three grants that we are expecting money from in our department. We will receive $131,937,411 for weatherization. So it was right in the middle of the numbers that we were thinking about. And then for the state energy program, it will be $54,172,000, an even number.
Okay. Thank you.
The money will come from the U.S. Department of Energy ultimately through a contract amendment. We will be asked to provide a plan and have a public hearing within 60 days after we get that first notification. I believe we'll be able to access 10% of the funds before that plan and the public hearing is accomplished. I haven't read all of the guidance, but I think there will be some acknowledgement that funds need to come forward for ramp-up. So, and then at the same time as we're doing the plan, the public hearing, we're requiring budgets of our service providers to come to us so that we can approve their plans and their budgets. And then we will do a contract with our service providers. Our service providers are on the map that I distributed, and I didn't make enough for all of you. So you can see that we have 32 agencies. I think six are tribal agencies, a nonprofit, and an HRA make up the service providers that we have to date. I've been in charge of this program since 2000, and we have had those same agencies running their programs, meeting these requirements that whole time that I've been here, and I think going back even many years before. So these are experienced people that are doing our program. Several years ago, 1995 or 6 or 7, it is several years ago, we migrated from doing an all-paper audit and reporting mechanism to a computer system. We worked with the Energy Assistance Program to create the Home Energy Assistance Program, EHEAT, which is a central bill paying mechanism for the utilities. And they have the eligibility portion built into that. So our program uses those citizens who are eligible for energy assistance to get weatherization. I've given you another sheet that shows the, it's called NEAT, it's the National Energy Audit Tool. And we collaborated with the Department of Energy, actually Oak Ridge National Lab, to make sure that many of the components that we were already doing in our Minnesota weatherization, our air sealing, our diagnostics with the blower door, to ensure that they were included in this software tool that we now use. In fact, we've got additional reports that the national tool doesn't have. We've already had Idaho and Washington call us in the last month wanting our NEAT tool rather than other states or the national tool. So it's a sound tool. It gives us the ability, after the auditor has gone through the audit, to plug in the information to let us know what is cost-effective and what isn't, so that we're doing the correct measures to the home most effectively.
And Ms. Streff, is that does that match up only for single-family residences?
No, it doesn't. It can be done duplexes, fourplexes, so it's the smaller multifamily. We haven't had a huge number of large units completed. I had somebody else look up some of those answers. Well, let's see. If you'd like, I can respond to that in writing. I know that you asked a few questions of me.
Okay.
I'm not putting my finger on it right
my
now.
My larger question is, what about apartment buildings? Do you have a tool that would
It's called TREAT is the one that we're looking at, and it's used certainly for multifamily buildings. We opted when we went with NEAT instead of TREAT because TREAT is focused more towards utility audits, where the end result says, homeowner, if you did X, you would save X amount of energy. And the NEAT tool tells us what's cost effective, and it's not a sales tool. So we have been asked by our agencies to look into that. We are. And Wisconsin uses it regularly. Certainly there can be some help from Wisconsin if we need to do something more quickly than we're ready to do.
Okay.
I wanted you to know that we are required as a state agency who receives the money to do a physical inspection of 5% of the homes. So this is something that we've got two monitors right now that do that as part of their job. One of the things that we are concerned about as well with this huge amount of money coming in and the new kinds of just trained folks or people who have been doing other kinds of contracting who might come in and do some of this, we want to make sure that there's sufficient quality control. And so it is our intention at this point to physically inspect 10% of the dwellings that are done in the state. So we've been preparing. I've talked with the CAP agencies, and you're going to hear from a couple of them. They're asking me questions like, what kind of money can you give me so I can ramp up even more quickly? They are figuring out how many trucks they need. Do they need additional space? They'll tell you. I know how they are ramping up. But it's everybody is saying, yes, we can do it. We know we want to hire contractors and new workers that have been trained and that know how to do this, but we will give them additional training. And are more than willing to have entities who think they can help to even contact them directly and see how else or how best the program can be expended, because it is going to be a larger program. I had one other thing before I leave that I guess I wanted to thank you and then toot our horn a little bit. 2 years ago, the legislature changed the law to require that the money that comes from our petroleum inspection fee, instead of being used to do weatherization for oil burning furnace residences, we transferred it into a renewable energy equipment program. And that program has been quite successful. We have one manufacturer of solar hot air collectors up in the north. He's focused solely on low-income homes. When it's put in and working, it can reduce the amount of energy, other energy that's needed to heat the home up to 30%. So it's been a good test of things. We're also using high-efficiency wood-burning stoves is the other one that some agencies have helped. We even, and you have another handout in your packet, but we even received a national award for it. So thank you. It's something that, as far as we know, no other agency or state is doing anything like this, and it's been successful and good. So I didn't want to take too long. I just wanted you to know that the numbers are real. We understand they're real. We have been planning since before the bill was signed, and are excited to be getting the money and doing good things. Thank you.
Well, are you able to tell us how many units are now weatherized annually and how many units have been weatherized thus far?
This year, including using money that we get from energy assistance and from the SIP program, we weatherized just under 4,000 homes. 39-something, I believe. At this point, the DOE guidance requires us to keep an average of, well, more people are going to know, 36-something. There are a lot more people who know that exact number here than I do, but it's in the $35 to $3,700 range. The guidance has changed that to up to $6,500. Dollars per house. So
you're saying there's been an increase in the amount allowable for each unit, or not only allowable but a must?
Madam Chair, no, it's allowable. It is not a must.
Okay.
As a number overall, I don't have that number at the tip of my tongue, but I can certainly get that for you.
Can you tell us what are your annual weatherization dollars and what weatherization money is available from all sources?
We receive money from the U.S. Department of Energy. We also, in the state plan for energy assistance each year, it has been annually 5% of the energy assistance funds. Some states go up to 15 and 20%. We have stayed at that number for many years. They're both good programs, and there's a lot of need in both. Let's see. I know last year we received just under $10 million. That's been pretty stable. However, this year we received supplemental funding for thank you. We received supplemental funding of $9,400,000. And for this year, for 2009-10, we'll also receive $9,100,000. And then in 2009 from LIHEAP, we received $7,226,000.
So is that your entire weatherization budget?
Madam Chair, yes. For this year, and then
that doesn't include the 5% from the
LIHEAP transfer, Madam Chair, is the 5%.
Okay. And how many audits do you do? Like You do an audit for every unit that you weatherize? Are there any units that you don't weatherize that you audit?
Madam Chair, we do an audit for every unit that we weatherize. We start audits and may not complete them because the house is a what we call a walkaway. That can be for several reasons. I think one of the most common reasons is that, for instance, their roof may leak and they don't have the funding to repair it. The weatherization dollars, in my view, sad to say, do not have that ability to pay for roof repair before then you weatherize the home. But it is a walkaway because you don't want to put additional insulation in the attic only to have it have water come down and ruin its effectiveness.
Okay. Do you have a plan for how you're going to distribute stimulus funds geographically around the state?
Madam Chair, are you talking weatherization?
Yeah, what did I say? Oh, the weatherization funds. Yeah.
Madam Chair, yes, we do. We are required every decade to reassess the allocation plan for the state. We intend to use the same allocation plan at this point, which provides funding to the existing service providers based on population and heating degree days. So are the two largest.
So how many units do you anticipate you will be able to weatherize?
Well, I believe that the U.S. Department of Energy will require us to weatherize a certain number of units based on the average of $6,500 per home. So we had run some numbers that were just a little bit, it's only $300,000. So at that point, we were at almost almost 17,000 units at the $6,500 a unit. If, say, we went down to 5,000 as an average, that's closer to 22,000 units. Last year, our average using SIP money and EAT money and DOE money ran about $4,000 on an average.
It doesn't figure out. Does that figure out?
Yeah. So how much do you anticipate being used for administration?
There are requirements and guidelines for that as well. No more than 10% can be used for administration. Historically, we have provided 7.5% to the CAP agencies, and the state has kept 2.5%. There's also a certain percentage that's allowed for training and technical assistance. Typically, it's 10% of the funding can be used for training and technical assistance. The guidance this time allows us to go up to 20%. Those are huge numbers, and we're still assessing what is needed. We know we need additional monitors if we're going to be monitoring 10% of the house of the units that are weatherized. So there'll be some additional staff at the state level. I'm hoping that 20% of the funds are not needed for training and technical assistance. My guess is not. Any of those funds are required, if they're not used for training and technical assistance, are required to go into the program fund. So ultimately, we would be, after we know what we needed, then we would push those into program.
And do you anticipate that we will expend all the money that we receive?
Madam Chair, absolutely.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. How do you say your last name? I'm sorry.
Streff.
Thank you, Ms. Streff. You did answer one of my questions. Your average, you said, historically has been about $4,000 per unit, and you can go up to $6,500. Do you anticipate using $6,500, or are you going to try and stay at that $4,000 level?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, the software helps us to be as cost-effective as we can. It gives us a list of the cost-effective strategies or measures that we should install. I would leave it maybe to the other CAP agency directors to also tell what's going on in theirs, agencies, but there's certain conservation measures, air sealing, insulation. Certainly if the furnace isn't working or it needs replacement, that would be another one. But those are very common cost-effective measures that are going to make a huge difference in the amount of energy that a homeowner then needs to pay. And so those, I think, are always done. If there's additional money that could be used to replace a water heater or do some other kind of conservation measure, they may look at that. I guess I would have to have you ask the agencies.
Okay. Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Rosen.
Thank you. Another question I had was you in the past distribute across the state to these agencies based on population and the heating degree days. Do you foresee any other factor that will play into that? Are you going to stay with that same formula? Has it worked for you in the past, or do you anticipate some other factor coming in that might adjust those amount of dollars?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, there were many meetings when we last did the allocation formula, and I would prefer to continue with that. We are not required to change that formula until the next census comes out.
Thank you.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my other question is, I'm just trying to think how this is all going to play out. Here we are doing training, and for some of these projects, and they're going to require a certain skill factor that's going to take a longer period of time to ramp up and train new people to be able to do this type of labor. And then also in the part of somebody that's providing a service, they're going to have to buy more equipment and add more people on to their force and gear up that way. And then all of a sudden, after 2 years, it's gone. Are we thinking long term how we're going to deal with that? I mean, is there measures in place?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, certainly at a national level, that's already been one of the discussions that's been going around. You know, it's not the ramp up, but it's the ramp down. And how do we ensure that that it's not like this and like that? I do think that, for example, one of the groups that we've been talking with and encouraging are members of the National Association of the Remodeling Industry. They have chapters throughout the state. They're contractors who do remodeling. And so that may be, for those agencies that hire contractors, may be a very good fit because they are not as busy right now. When the economy improves and other business picks up, then they'll go back and do that. So we're hoping that some of those kinds of labor situations will be there.
Okay. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Streff, if you covered this already, I apologize. I understand with the federal dollars coming in, there's also some new eligibility requirements. That's my understanding anyway. It's something to go up to about 200% of the federal poverty guidelines, up from 125. Is the Department of Commerce planning on matching those provisions?
Ms. Streff.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, currently we use the eligibility requirements for the LIHEAP program. They do a tremendous amount of intake every year for their energy assistance, and so it certainly streamlines the amount of work that's needed for our program and doesn't cost us as much either. The LIHEAP program currently uses 50% of state median income, which is a little over $40,000 for a family of four. And I'm sorry I didn't bring an analysis, so this is from memory, but I believe that translating that into the federal, it comes out to about 180 or 185%. So we're right in the middle of, I think that the feds are allowing us to go up to 200%.
So you already had 180, 185. Sorry. And, Madam Chair, Ms. Strapp, the other question I had was, I had some discussions earlier about trying to create some efficiencies within certain programs we already have existing. Now that we have this in money coming for weatherization, you're going to be in the house, and a lot of those homes will be older, and some of the windows, though I know they're not as energy efficient, and that generally we're not going to be putting too much money into window replacement. Once we're in the homes doing weatherization, is there a way to have in our audit process a checkoff box or something to determine whether or not, you know, a window is suspect or it's houses of an age where it should be looked at for lead an abatement program? Since we have people already in the house, and then alert that particular agency to that need. Is there a way for us to do that?
Ms. Streff?
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, yes, certainly there is. And our program is has guidance that requires us to be cognizant of possible lead situations and certain requirements to be met when they, in fact, do meet them. Certainly, we know that lead dust around windows is one of the greater hazards. That could be something that we could add is to make that a component. I also, I guess the other thing I was thinking about was one of the other programs that we are thinking about as a possible use of some of the stimulus money is to work with the Minnesota Finance Housing Agency to use their fix-up fund, which is from up to a family four of $96,000. To make sure that people are aware of that loan program and then to perhaps help them to purchase the windows at a lower interest rate, alert them to the tax credit that is just being increased up to 30% of $1,500, and with other stimulus money, we were thinking to help provide for funding for labor for that up to 30% as well. So we're still trying on some different scenarios that that could help that strata of income level.
Yeah. Madam Chair,
Senator Dahl.
Ms. Streff, thank you for that, and I certainly want to follow up with you as you're developing that and see how that's going and assist any way I can. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Streff, the weatherization also includes public buildings and schools. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator sure. Rosen, it does include it's housing. So public housing is typically done through HUD programs. Schools are not included since they're not housing. But again, we are working closely with MHFA to ensure that we are using our weatherization dollars with the public housing dollars to make everything stretch as far as it can. And we've already met with them at least three times to be sorting out which programs will work where and how we can work together.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. So school buildings could at some point be involved with these dollars. I guess I'm not quite following.
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, schools are not schools are commercial buildings or institutional buildings, and so they would not fall under the low income weatherization program. What the program that they do fall under that we are looking at is using funds from either the state energy program or the conservation block grant that will be coming to help encourage school districts, school buildings, to owners to start with the Public Buildings Enhanced Energy Efficiency Program, which is something that the legislature passed last year, and we're just about ready to launch it. And that takes a building owner through a technical assessment, which is like a commercial building audit rather than an energy auditor. It's an energy manager, I guess. And then to, once we have their list of most cost-effective and best energy conservation measures, help them to get into a tax-exempt lease that will help to pay for that, with the thinking that the energy savings pays for the payments for the tax-exempt lease. The incentive that we would give would buy down the tax, the lease. We think that might create the most interest, but we are again looking at different options on how to incent school districts to step up to the plate and use that program and do something.
Senator Romo.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Jeff. I apologize if I missed this point. Are these weatherization funds are available to rental? If I own a rental unit and someone else is living in there?
Ms. Jeff.
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, they are. They have always been for rental properties. I know that question's been raised quite a bit, and I've been asking some of the agencies, and again, you might ask them when they testify. However, it's my understanding that the problem that's arisen is that typically when we do we do work with the landlord and get their permission, one of the requirements is that they not raise the rent on the tenant, and many of them choose not to do that. So I don't think it's been as high. I did, however, notice in the guidance, as I was reading through it very quickly at another hearing, that they are suggesting that this is stimulus money and that maybe we do need to look at relaxing those kinds of things. So we will be reading that more closely and seeing what we can do.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Streff. Now I'd like to call on Harlan Tardy, William Davis, and Arnie Anderson.
Certainly.
Welcome to the committee.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senators. My name is Arnie Anderson. I'm the director of the Minnesota Community Action Partnership. We are thrilled to be here today. We have been advocating for increased weatherization funds with Congress for years and years. And while we regret the confluence of events that has produced these funds and the consequences for low-income families in general, we're thrilled about this energy conservation opportunity. As the agenda indicated, today we have William Davis, President and CEO of Community Action of Minneapolis, and Harlan Tardy, Executive Director of Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency from Virginia, Minnesota. They will both be speaking briefly. They represent not only the geographic distribution, but also the two primary models for delivering weatherization. AEOA uses a crew model, and Minneapolis uses a contractor model. And you all have had many questions about both. Before I give up the microphone, I would like to draw the Senator's attention to this purple report and the red tab within the report. Just to refresh the wide array of programming that a community action agency carries in their back pocket when they go to weatherize a home. There are many secondary benefits that accrue in many expected and unexpected ways. With that, I would like to introduce to you Mr. Harlan Tardy, Arrowhead Economic Opportunity Agency.
Thank you. Mr. Tardy.
Yeah, Madam Chair and committee, I too thank you for this opportunity. AEOA, if you look at the map that was handed out, we're the Lavender Way up in the northeast corner. It does include the city of Duluth and the balance of St. Louis County, Lake and Cook County. In addition to that, for weatherization, we do contracts with Fond du Lac and Grand Portage for their weatherization services at the current time as well. So that's kind of the geographic area we serve. And we do use a crew model. We have, for close to the past 30 years, done our weatherization work with crews that we hire, the auditors, housing inspectors, and the crew workers that go out and weatherize these individual homes, or these homes out there. And ours currently happen to be steel workers. They are unionized. They are with labor contracts and has proven to be a good match for us. It's worked out very well. They do have significant benefits, health, dental, life, and an annuity participation as well. So we would plan to continue that model to the extent possible. But I'm here to tell you we would also look at what other means possible in order to get our arms around this. If for some reason we weren't able to do it with crews, we certainly would look at other supportive structures out through our communities, whether that be other contractors or some other providers that we partner with within our region. Just to give you an example, we opened an auditor position about a week and a half ago, and in 3 days received 47 applications, of which the vast majority already had a number of skills that would be transferable to this. That might be also a sign of the bad turndown of the mining industry that we have across the Iron Range as well. But I don't think there's going to be any problem finding the employees we need, and many of them are going to come with excellent skills right from the get-go. But we also try to blend in some other kinds of things. We have some senior employees that have done this for years and years and years, and we will certainly use them in leadership roles and blend crew members into those crews in order to get our arms around all of these homes. But we do try to, as a CAP agency, blend in some other things like youth build, some high school dropouts involved in work initiatives to gain work experience in the trades. We would use MFIP clients that whenever possible to blend in and get and receive training as well. A number of other youth activities, we would also look at all of those kinds of things to kind of find a nice blend so we do what the intent is trying to bring some people into the labor force. So we would do those kinds of things. We currently, and I did a poll of CAP agencies around the state just recently. We've had numerous discussions as to whether we could do this, and we very emphatically believe that, yes, we can. If we are given the opportunity, we would find the partners if we need them in addition to what we currently do, and we would get the job done. We would be sure to work with partners throughout our communities and listen to them and find out where they might be able to come to the table and help us get this thing done. We all have waiting lists. If you're wondering, are the homes out there? Do we have homes ready to go? Absolutely, yes. I mean, through our energy assistance program, we use the same application over to weatherization, and we have literally thousands of homes on the waiting list right now. And to get started, and then we continue to do outreach after that. But once this hits the ground and we get the money, we have no problem with getting started with the numbers of homes that are necessary to get this thing started. One last area that I'd like to touch on. We're We have most of our agencies have dual hats. We don't just do weatherization energy. We do housing things and other programs out through community action. And so we'll be looking at blending dollars. Someone mentioned, or I think Janet did mention, the home with the leaky roof or the foundation problems and those kinds of things. You know, we need to. Some of them are the poorest of the families that we have to deal with, and they just can't afford to have that roof done so that we can come in and weatherize or something like that. So we need to be innovative in looking across various housing programs that are out there, whether we deliver them or not, and find ways to do that whole house. If you're going to do it, you know, you need to do it right. And so we will be blending these dollars to make it as effective as possible out through those homes. A lot has been said about energy savings and green jobs and those kinds of savings. I'd like to tell you one little project that our agency is initiating is because we do the Congress Dining and Meals on Wheels, we're going to be exchanging with the permission of some of these seniors their light bulbs, and we're going to bring in some energy-saving opportunities throughout our communities, and particularly our first target is seniors, but we hope that we can find some partners with some of the utilities or other partners to help us with some of those costs and try to bring other energy kind of innovative ways into saving energy. And I know I could give you a half dozen more, but I'll pass it on to Bill.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Davis.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm William Davis, the President and CEO for Community Action Minneapolis, and we run the weatherization program in Minneapolis, and we've been doing this for well over 20, 30 years now. We've weatherized well over 40,000 homes in Minneapolis as well. Currently, are contracted to weatherize approximately 340 homes a year. That's down from a high of about 700 homes in the early 90s. As a program, we're ready to ramp up and to provide a quality service to the people that we've served over the years. We use right now 11 crews, and we've already had a conversation with them a few months ago, in fact, about ramping up and being prepared to take on the anticipated increase in the number of homes that we will be serving. So there's no hesitation on their part, on our part. We're just simply waiting for the money to become available so that we can begin this project. You know, the thing that we're most concerned about is getting started. We have probably, and we're anticipating with the new money, having to increase our capabilities to do about 14 to 1,500 homes a year. While that may be challenging, it is certainly doable. And we, again, have positioned ourselves, and we're ready to go once we receive the green light to go ahead. The one thing we know for sure is that the ending date is fixed. It's fixed at 2010, September 30th of 2010. We just need to get this program started and start assisting people that are desperately in need. We are concerned and will continue to work closely with other organizations that are training individuals to do this type of work. We want to make sure that they meet our protocol, make sure that they are certifiable. We also, in our agency, and I'm sure for most of the agencies, we also require our employees to submit to criminal background checks. We want to make sure that the people that go into these vulnerable individuals' homes are there to do the work and nothing else. We want to make sure that we're not subjecting people to an element that they shouldn't be subjected to. So we are looking at all the safeguards in this program, making sure that those that we serve are receiving quality service. I just wanted to mention, because the question was raised about the outcomes, we certainly are concerned about the outcome, measurable outcomes. We want to have a pool We anticipate a pool of about 30 to 45 people that we will be hiring as a result of this program. And I know we understand that this is also a jobs program. The stimulus is part of its thrust is to hire people, get them back into employment. We not only want to hire them, we also want to retain them. And we're talking to the contractors and the vendors that we're using about retaining these individuals after the program has concluded. We still will have work to do. We still anticipate there being a weatherization program after this first stimulus package is concluded. So we want to have opportunities for people who bring forth skills and have a desire and an interest to work in this industry. So we're certainly in tune with that need. Some of the things that we want to make sure is that we remove as many impediments as possible so that we can maximize our ability to weatherize homes. We firmly believe that 200%, which is allowable, should be the number that we use. We know that there are people who are recently unemployed, people who are experiencing a result of the downturn in the economy that are just in need, just as much in need of our services as anyone else. We want also to make sure there's consistency across the board with some of our other programs. Some of our other programs have already talked and are hedging towards the 200% level. So we want to make sure that there's some consistency so we don't confuse the public by having different entry points for people who are seeking our services. We plan to continue to be transparent, as we have in the past, in terms of delivery of our services. We submit to audits and monitoring by the state. We know that. We've done that. We just heard we're going to have that increase, and we welcome that because we feel that we've demonstrated our capacity time and time again and won't have any problems with that. Some of the other concerns we have are, as you heard earlier, about the walkaways, and those are homes that we have not been allowed to go in and insulate, even though they're eligible for the program because they may have a leaky roof or a leaky foundation. Many of these homes we go into, we also observe poor plumbing and wiring, and lead abatement is clearly an issue and a concern for us as well. We think that this program gives us the flexibility to do an array of repairs in a household, and we should exercise that. We should not find reason to restrict what we do, but we should be looking at ways to increase what we do. We get into these homes, we have a one-shot, so let's make it a one-shot stop so that we're not coming back over and over again. Ultimately, as a result of these programs, we are able to reduce the energy consumption. We improve the quality of life for the residents in that household. In our community, we find that a number of these households are occupied by the elderly who, unfortunately, are left to raise their grandchildren. So not only are we affecting the elderly population, but also the youth growing up. So I'm going to stop because I'm sure you have some questions for us, but it suffices to say, and I want to leave you with this, that we are ready to go forward with this project. We clearly have the capacity to deliver, and we want to make this program be successful, but we don't want to be saddled with restrictions that are going to cause us not to be successful.
Mr. Davis, I thought I heard you say that you would be ramping up to do about 1,300 to 1,400 homes a year.
Correct.
What are you doing currently?
We're doing about 350 homes, Madam Chair.
And you also mentioned that you wanted to be able to go in and do repairs. and you said you didn't want to be saddled with restrictions, but these are weatherization dollars. Do you have other funds that you can add to that for some of these
repairs? Madam Chair, we always, in all of our programs, we look to leverage our dollars. We are in conversation with other funding sources, and we certainly would like to have a comprehensive approach through the weatherization program. Weatherization, I alluded to earlier that we have been doing this for a number of years. Over the last several years, the program has been contracted. We've been asked to do less and less in the homes, and partly for efficiency and partly because there were fewer dollars available. Given that these dollars have increased substantially, we think this is a golden opportunity to make the best of them.
Okay. And Mr. Tardy, you mentioned that you have a waiting list of thousands of people. How long do people stay on the waiting list before they qualify or are in line for their weatherization?
Madam Chair, that's statewide thousands. AEOA, thanks for letting me clarify that. No, AEOA does have a significant waiting list, but not thousands. But statewide, we certainly have thousands. And the second question was?
Well, that was my first question. I haven't articulated the second. How many homes do you weatherize a year?
We're almost identical to Bill's numbers. We're about 340 this current year, and we're expecting a very similar number in expansion.
Okay. Any questions? So you think you'll have no trouble using up all the money, huh?
Not from our standpoint, Madam Chair, and I think that's the consensus of our group. We want to do this project. We know this is an opportunity for us to demonstrate our capacity. We know the need is in the community. We just need to have all the impediments and barriers removed to allow us to do our job.
Madam Chair, we've asked for this opportunity for years. Now we have to deliver.
Well, we'll hold you to it. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Davis, you had said something about some checks, background checks, and folks. So we have know that those folks going into homes are, you know, not are there to do their work only.
Exactly.
How long is it? I mean, as far as we're looking at reducing some of the hurdles and stuff, but in getting this ramped up, are you preparing that for that right now, or is that something that's going to be an ongoing? And how long is that kind of that process? Does that normally take?
Madam Chair, Senator, we have been in communication with our vendors. We have been out scouring the landscape to make sure that we have shovel-ready projects and individuals and organizations. And we think in a couple of weeks, within 30 days, we will be ready to go full bore.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Davis, so you have a pretty good list then already of contractors and folks that you know are qualified and have been in the community for a while that can perform this work.
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, we have talked with a number of organizations, including Lewis King's organization, Hire. We've had a conversation with them about providing us with skilled and trained individuals to augment the services or the vendors that we're currently using. We've talked to our vendors about expanding their operation. We've been keeping them in the loop, making sure that they understand our commitment and our challenge. We simply were waiting for the numbers. We were waiting for the startup dollars to make this happen.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. And Mr. Davis, you did mention that you didn't want to be impeded in your ability to move forward.
Sure.
Do you anticipate any type of state impediments or obstacles that you'd have to overcome?
I don't, Madam Chair. I don't think that at this time we're just getting the information and the guidance. I mean, I think some of these things are subject to interpretation. I'm simply saying that there's some opportunities here that we should avail ourselves of, and I think that whatever we're allowed to do within the scope of the regulations, we should exercise that. If they tell us that we can go up to 200%, then we need to exercise that. If they say that we can do windows and doors and roofs and other kinds of things, we should take advantage of that.
Okay, and what about training? How difficult will it be to train people as you hire them to prepare them to go out and do this type of
work? Well, Madam Chair, I know that the state has been very supportive of getting training dollars out. I know there's a training course available right now at Dunwoody for auditors. We have, again, been engaged in conversation with organizations like the Summit Academy, who has a training program for construction. We've also talked to our contractors for other names We've also talked to the Minority Business Association, and we are gathering a very healthy list of people that are ready to go. They may need a week or two of additional training to meet our protocols, but they're certainly ready to hit the ground running. This whole stimulus bill has been talked about now for several months, and so people know that this was forthcoming, and in anticipation of that, they were positioning themselves to be ready to deliver this product.
Okay. Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you guys just address the process? Once you have somebody signed up to do a weatherization, you know, once you do an audit, you line up materials, do you have to get building permits for these projects, or are they small enough that you don't need building permits? And just kind of go through your whole process on a home.
If you would.
Mr. Tardy.
Senator, Madam Chair, Senator, I'm sorry, I can't see your name there, but there's a very extensive process that after the auditing of the project is completed, then there's a I guess I forgot the actual question.
I was wondering about, they do the audit. Do you have somebody on staff ordering materials, yeah, aligning all that stuff up, and getting building permits? And
yes, the building
kind of
permits.
See this almost an
assembly. Madam Chair.
Mr. Chardy.
The materials, we buy bulk and do this because we anticipate a large number of projects to do that. But as far as building permits and whatever, a lot of communities are different. And so and across the Iron Range, in our small little communities, all of them might have different codes. And so we certainly have to have housing inspectors' ability to address those individual codes. Most of them are pretty uniform, and they do work quite closely. But all of the above is true. We do all of that.
Madam Chair,
Mr. Davis.
Senator, in our situation, we have a pre-audit and a post-audit. We send an auditor out that will do a blower door exam of the household, determine the air infiltration in the house where we can maximize energy savings. We then have the crew come in, perform the work. Then we come back and do a post-audit to make sure they fully comply with our specifications. If they don't, then we call them back in before we pay them to make sure that the work is done properly.
Okay. One more, then we need to move on.
Thanks.
Senator Olsen.
There's this checklist that I don't know who's got this checklist, but boy, there's a lot of stuff on here from, pressure fittings and all that, but it says like replacing glass on windows. So I know you're not a window replacement program, but if there's a broken window, do you replace that at the same time? And
yes.
And who goes through that checklist? My God.
Mr. Tardy?
Madam
Tardy?
Chair, Senator, yes, we our auditors do go through those checklists, and within the confines that we have of dollars, we try to do all those things. That's where some of the limitations do come with, bigger items. If the threshold of dollars goes up, we'll be able to go farther with those. But yes, all of those are critical.
Madam Chair and Senator Olsen, if I may.
Mr. Anderson.
The chart was included just as a graphic illustration of the complexity of administering the Department of Energy Weatherization Program and the degree of thought on the part of a number of people that go into this fairly specific program. And Madam Chair, if I may, you asked previously if we felt that the state was an impediment. And I just want to emphasize quite the contrary. Community action agencies work with a large number of state agencies. And the Department of Commerce's Office of Energy Security is one of the most professional, does one of the best jobs of communication, and is one of the most effective collaborators with whom we work. And we are very excited about working with them to make this project successful.
Well, we knew that. We weren't criticizing them. But if sometimes we can do something about changing things at the state level, which we can't do at the local level, you'd be on your own there. I just was wondering if there's any way that we can assist you more. But thank you for your comments.
All right. Thank you.
Ms. Streff, do you have anything you want to add?
Madam Chair, I think
I think they covered it well, and Bill and I have been talking about a couple of the impediments that he mentioned, and we're going to see whether DOE can help out, and if there's something we can do at the state level for one.
Okay. Thanks.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator.
Maybe just a yes or no answer. As you would go out and do one of these and make the improvements, and Senator Olstein pointed out the building permit issue. Just hypothetically, let's just say a building permit or permits an aggregate of maybe a couple $1,000s. Does that come out of the homeowner's pocket, or is that part of the program? If there are somewhat major building permit costs with the local unit of government.
Would anybody care to answer that? Ms. Streff?
Madam Chair, since I did work with building codes, I think I'm more familiar. They are now statewide building codes, which I think might help streamline some of the questions that we've had as to whether we need a building permit or not. But the program does pay for all permit costs. The homeowner doesn't pay anything.
Okay, thank you. Pam Marshall.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Pam Marshall. I have directed the Energy Sense Coalition for the past 17 years. Our organization combines legislative advocacy, intervention in Public Utilities Commission's proceedings, and direct services to promote more affordable utility service for low and fixed income energy consumers. One of the direct service programs that we administer in conjunction with our partner organization, the St. Paul Neighborhood Energy Connection, is Xcel Energy's Low Income Conservation Improvement Program, or SIP. The area that we do is in the East Metro area. Our low-income SIP program is funded at about $1 million a year. And with that money, we are able to do both gas and electric conservation services in about 270 homes each year. The households that get assistance through SIP receive energy audits, insulation, furnace, water heater replacements, and also electric appliance replacements. I want to preface my remarks about the federal low-income weatherization program today by saying that as low-income energy advocates, EnergySense wants to work with all of the involved stakeholders in making sure that we can provide the most comprehensive, most cost-effective services to the most income-eligible households possible. We think the enormous influx of money and the lack of currently trained energy auditors and insulation crew members presents a significant challenge to reaching that goal. We don't believe the challenge is necessarily insurmountable. We do believe, however, that it will take all of us who are committed to low-income energy programs to make it a success. We have concerns about the ramp-up, a lot of which were mentioned today, particularly if the funds must be spent by September 30th, 2010, and if there is not some way to sustain an increase in weatherization funding above Minnesota's typical allocation. I just want to run through a couple of those concerns. We also work with insulation contractors in delivering the Xcel Energy Low-Income SIP program. We met with about four of them a couple weeks ago, and they're reluctant to expand. They believe this may be temporary. One potential remedy to this problem, if there is some way in which the DOE regs allow it, is to offer these contractors some sort of access to the technical assistance money. For example, a cost share purchase, equipment purchase, or lease to own something program so that we get over the barrier that they've said they face, which is pretty heavy capital outlay for an expansion that could very well be temporary.
We're down to Pam.
And those insulation contractors, because there, as you heard today, there are only five current weatherization program providers that act with in-house crews, we're going to have to help the existing insulation contractors to equip and train and to expand the crews that they have now. Secondly, the Weatherization Assistance Program Technical Assistance Center, what's called WAPTAC, which is the resource for weatherization service providers nationwide, they estimate it takes 6 to 8 months of formal training, including supervised field work, to meet the core competency requirements for performing energy audits. So this isn't, you know, a couple of weeks and then you're out performing audits in homes. The training is going to take extensive investment than that. Those with building trade experience can obviously be trained in less time, but will still require both some level of classroom and some field training component. Compounding this problem, it's my understanding that the Dunwoody Energy Auditor training is booked through the week of June 22nd, and that while they intend on adding new courses, again, that course doesn't include field training at this time. And that training, of course, is critical to providing energy audits. Third, and again, according to WAPTAC, not only does the capacity of the current network of service providers need to expand, but also, according to them, the number of current service providers should double to reach the ramp-up goals. You know, at the same time, I realized that it would be time-consuming to identify additional agencies and to include them as OES subcontractors. And while I don't have a magical solution to this problem, I think we at least need to discuss it and try to come up with some. One idea is that perhaps other organizations, such as organizations with construction trade training programs, may be willing to take on this role and perhaps could use the existing the expertise of the existing service provider network to train crews at those construction trade organizations who could then subcontract with the local agencies. That way, existing crews would be in the field, they would be using their expertise to train potentially other agencies, and we'd still be accomplishing audits at the same time. In addition to the obvious, the auditors and the insulation crew members, we need trainers to train them. And I'm not sure of the number of or the availability of people who could act as trainers now, but again, WAPTAC estimates that several times more trainers need to be available if we're going to meet these goals. I have not yet seen the regulations and the restrictions or the criteria for how this money could be used, but I do think there are some decisions we can make independent of those rules to reach these goals and to assist people in the most effective way. First, I think we should just make the determination that the very first priority for assistance under these dollars will be for households with high energy consumption. Secondly, I believe that the energy savings potential in 1-4 unit rental homes is significant and that they should also receive priority for these funds. Third, given that the average per unit weatherization investment is now increased to $6,500, our organization believes that Minnesota's program should use all the additional available funds. You heard about the energy assistance transfer to supplement the weatherization program. There's also an emergency repair and replacement program for mechanical work in addition, and it's my understanding that there is also health and safety money that's available as well. Given all of those funds and that the $6,500 is a per unit average, it seems to me that we should, from all sources, cap that average at $6,500. In other words, I don't believe that we need to spend $6,500 in DOE funds alone and then plan, as we sit here today, to spend more money in each dwelling because not all of these dwellings will require that level. In addition, I believe the significantly higher average unit investment should utilize additional funds to replace hot water heaters and electric appliances measures that the program doesn't currently do. Fourth, as you've heard, the current weatherization program relies on the energy assistance program to identify income-eligible households, and it's important to know that about 44% of our state's energy assistance population lives at incomes at or below 100% of the federal poverty. We definitely need a way, both within the energy assistance program and beyond it, to get to that 200% of federal poverty. Finally, we think that reporting will be key to our success. We think that in addition to the reporting the number of units and the average amount spent on each, reports should include which measures were installed or what mechanical or health and safety investments were made and from what funding source, the number of the rental units by the size of those dwellings, and the number of households assisted by income level. Again, EnergySense wants this expansion to succeed, and we urge all of the stakeholders to keep in mind that this program is important in terms of potential energy savings and job creation, but it is also, if not foremost, a way to help low-income people improve and maintain their homes and to better afford essential utility service. That's all I have. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Marshall, in my district, there's a lot of trades people that are not working. And I think for ramping up for this, there's not going to be a problem, you know, whether it's carpenters or, you know, the trades are just, they were building thousands of homes in my area, and now that's, there's probably 10 building permits. So there's going to be people that can come out of the woodwork to do this. I don't see that as much of an issue. But I do appreciate what you said. I thought it was pretty thoughtful about, you know, coordinating a lot of this stuff and making sure that there's follow-up. And so I think that makes sense, but I don't think you have to be so worried about finding people. I think they'll be running down here.
Ms. Marshall.
Madam Chair and Senator, I don't disagree that there are people with transferable skills. I think the energy auditing and the insulation crew members are sort of two different pieces. I do think there's a building design and mechanical training component to the energy auditors that, or to the energy auditing, that is important, and that is, it's important to acknowledge, even with general building trades experience, is not necessarily just transferable within a week's or so time. I'm not saying there aren't those people who are skilled out there. I'm saying we have to be mindful that it will take some time to shift folks into that, and on the insulation crew members as well. And I'm basically trying to convey to you what insulation contractors with whom we work are saying. They won't let a crew member go out on a job without about 4 months of following them around in dense packing walls.
Mr. Tardy, could you come to the table? Would you be able to respond to the how you're going to ramp up with the auditors?
Madam Chair, yes. We have already had postings for additional auditors. In fact, in response to the senator here, we have actually had full-fledged housing inspectors apply for some of them positions. So we do believe we are going to have a number of very, very qualified people into our fold very, very quickly, and they can step up. But a second piece to that is we've already got a lot of good experienced staff now that they can shadow and work with on those crews and get that mentoring that was mentioned. We're not planning on sending them out in crews with all green. They're gonna be working alongside experienced people who have done this for a significant time.
Yes, like up in my district, like Senator Olsen's, we have double-digit unemployment and a very highly skilled people. And we're anticipating this might be a bridge to help carry them over, even if those, some of them can't be retained until they're able to go back to their other jobs. Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Marshall, I think you make some really good points. It's not about knowing how to do this stuff. It's about what we're supposed to do, and that's where those energy auditors come in. And I'm concerned about that a lot, too. I know you got 47 applicants for that one job, but, you know, are they really qualified to the point where we need them to be, you know? And I think in the first round we might find there's a lot of folks that are sitting idle or they're, you know, they could do more. But to get to the point where we want to be with this whole program, we're going to need a lot more people, and I agree that the program that is being done at Dunwoody is not long enough. I mean, they need a more extensive training to be able to do the level of, you know, competency that we need for these energy audits. And I'm concerned that we don't have enough of that going on. I'd like to have, if I could, Ms. Streff come back and just talk about that for a minute, if we could, to know what the plans are across the state to really meet that need.
Is Ms. Streff still here?
Yes, I am.
Sorry to put you on the spot. But. Madam Chair, thank you. Ms. Streff, what I was interested in is a couple of questions on that. The program that was running, if we could get an idea what the cost of the program is currently at Dunwoody, and, you know, what are the other kind of things that are in the works right now? Are we working with the trades? Are we working with the utilities? Are we working with the tech schools? Not only in terms of this, you know, for where we'd have these facilities to get the auditors, but as Ms. Marshall alludes to, is the trainers, having qualified trainers to run these classes. And are we going to expand the scope? Because you know, that experience, being able to get out in the field and get up to speed, what are some of those things? Could you address some of those things for me, please?
Ms. Streff.
Certainly, Madam Chair. Senator Dahl. Multi-stepped question there. Let me see if I remember it all. The Dunwoody course was formed actually in response to our SIP program for the utilities as they ramped up their residential program. So it has come into play here at a good time. We have met with Dunwoody, they've met with various technical colleges throughout the state. They have scheduled trainings in, I believe, both Bemidji and Brainerd, and are working and Cloquet, and are working on a more southern campus for training there as well. We have met with them on advanced trainings for auditors, also insulation and air sealing, a specific course on that. There are others outside of the department who are also working on those components. So it's, I think that there will be several pebbles put into the pond with ripples. I know that the Center for Energy and the Environment is also working on an insulation and air sealing program and plan to provide that curriculum to others to train. As far as your comment about trainers, I think that that's a very good one, and I don't have a ready answer to that as far as who is interested and wants to step forward to maybe take additional on. So I guess I would like to take that one back with me, and I don't remember.
Well,
the
and
last
Madam Chair,
piece.
And,
Senator Dahl,
Ms. Streff, the I guess another follow up question would be: is the money that we're getting going to be able to use for this? I know there was that initial grant for the Dunwoody program. Are we going to be able to use some of this federal money to get that out there? And are we working with the utilities and the unions, the different trade unions, to work to do this as well?
Certainly. Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, we are working with certainly been talking with the utilities. I know others have met with the unions. I haven't met directly with them myself. I'm meeting directly with Minsky indeed tomorrow to talk about training and how do we steer the dislocated workers to that training, because they have funding that can help pay for some of those scholarships. In the weatherization group, certainly as employees of weather of the CAP agencies, they have some of that training paid for as well. There's a lot of money for training and technical assistance, up to 20%, which is a huge amount. And so I appreciated what Pam said as far as how do we ensure that the insulators are getting the right training. I think there are some restrictions as far as what kind of equipment can be purchased, but there may be ways that we can work with that is they work with agencies. So I think this is going to give us a lot of opportunities to find different ways to work together that we haven't started to do that quite yet.
Thank you.
And I think we'll move along now, and we'll probably ask you to come back in a month or so and give us an update on how things are going. At this time, we're going to jump down to the bottom of our agenda to Senate File 540. Senator Erickson Ropes actually has a bill that is not relying on stimulus funds. And this is scheduled to go to the floor if it passes on. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Yes, I'm happy to bring you a very positive bill today that doesn't cost you any money. This is a bill about local wind, and I'm just going to give you a quick background on it. Winona County began work on a community winds project in 2005, and as the first county in the state to do that, we began running into some trailblazer obstacles. And we were advised then that the county did not have the authority to own and operate a wind turbine. So in 2007, I carried a bill, and it was passed into law that gave Winona County the authority to own and operate a wind turbine. And then the next year, I believe Senator Kubley carried a bill and gave all counties the authority to own and operate wind turbines. The ownership and financing structure has run into some problems along the way. And first, we wanted to do a joint powers authority as a way to fund this local project, and that didn't work out. Then the county considered being the sole owner and had some financing problems there. And we've determined the only way to move forward on this community wind project with clean, renewable energy is to opt for the Minnesota FLIP model. And this model requires the creation of an LLC. And counties cannot enter into LLCs with private equity investors. So on the other hand, county EDAs can enter into LLPs, but that would not allow us to be able to take advantage of the tax credits and other benefits of the community project. So we have a bill before you today that would grant Winona County Economic Development Authority the authority to form or become a part of a member of a limited liability corporation. And I have with me here today Linda Grover, who is the executive director of Winona County EDA, and she can answer some specific questions that you might have about the project.
Ms. Grover, welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair and Senators, I don't have a lot to add in addition to what Senator Ropes has offered, but I certainly am more than willing to answer any specific questions that you have. Being a trailblazer, as she described it, has been quite an interesting experience, and we're certainly willing to share our knowledge and stumbles with any other county and unit of government that is hoping to do a similar project.
Any questions? Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question. Senator Erickson Ropes, you mentioned that Senator Kubley had a bill to do this statewide. Should your bill be statewide, I mean, for allowing other counties to do this, or is this kind of a first step and mm-hmm. we can work on that in the future?
Yeah. Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, that's
Erickson
a great question. I have been asked this question in other committees, and I'd be happy to follow it up with a statewide authority request. But at this point, Winona County is looking for the authorization, and it is a first step. So this bill is for Winona County, but if that sails through this year, I'm pretty sure I'll be back asking for the same authority for all counties.
I'm not sure that's the direction we're looking to go, but...
Okay.
I wouldn't expand it. I mean, I would just stick with your own county at this point.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble.
I'm happy to move the bill when it's time, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, I move Senate File 540 be recommended to pass and referred
to the floor.
To the floor.
Any discussion on the motion? And all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And the next bill will be Senate File 1405.
What are we doing in
situation? I was going to ask about she was cautious about
here, you can
it going to other counties. I'd like to know that ahead of time because you're setting
but shouldn't they look at it?
Trust me.
All right. We are now going to hear Senate File 1405 with Senator Pretner Solon. Senator Pretner Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have the wrong file. Well, I have the wrong file. Would you bring me the other file? Mr. Chair, Senate File 1405 is a residential energy efficiency bill, and a variety of organizations in Duluth have been working on energy efficiency and green job development. Early last fall, the city, housing organizations, the utilities, economic development, and environmental organizations met to further focus the conversation in light of volatile energy prices, an increasing energy affordability gap, a need to reduce carbon footprint, and a desire to create local green job opportunities. Although the conversation involved a number of sustainable community measures, the first step focused on air sealing and weatherization. Since that time, development of the Duluth Energy Efficiency Program has occurred. This program is based upon the idea that investment in energy efficiency should be predicated on the biggest bang for the buck. As the Finance Committee begins to appropriate the funds from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, I wanted to present this residential program as it could successfully accomplish the job creation and energy conservation goals of the stimulus package. And I've invited Jody Slick from Duluth Green Jobs Initiative and Common Ground, Councillor Tony Cuneo from the Duluth City Council, and also from the A.H. Zeppa Family Foundation, and Dean Talbot, Minnesota Power, to discuss this residential energy efficiency program.
Well, Ms. Slick, welcome to the committee. For the record, introduce yourself, and then we'll hear your testimony.
Sure. We've prepared a presentation, and I apologize for the dog and pony show, but we've got different people that will be talking about the variety of slides. I am Jody Slick. I'm Executive Director of Common Ground, which is a social enterprise of the Northern Communities Land Trust, an affordable housing provider, and we have focused on green affordable housing and construction for the past 5 years. And I'm also the project leader for the Duluth Green Jobs Initiative, which was started actually in partnership with the foundations in town to start a strategic planning process to develop green jobs. And kind of starting out today in the presentation is City Councilor Tony Cuneo, who is also with the Zeppa Foundation.
Okay. Mr. Cuneo, I'll ask you to do the same, just to introduce yourself to for the record, and we'll hear what you have to say. Thank you.
Great, thank you. And thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the members of the committee for hearing us today. My name is Tony Cuneo. I sit as an at-large representative on the Duluth City Council and serve as the Director of Policy and Planning at the A.H. Zeppa Family Foundation. And so today we're going to talk, as Jody mentioned, about this Duluth Energy Efficiency Program. And we're going to try and talk about it from three perspectives. First, from the perspective of the array of organizations that we've already brought to the table in large part, you've been hearing questions through much of the testimony today about training programs and the sustainability of these jobs. We wanted to bring together, and actually we've been talking about these ideas since before we were aware of stimulus possibilities that would help, you know, kickstart it. But we wanted to bring together a group of organizations that can kind of tackle all of those questions, training processes, long-term job sustainability. Second, we want to talk about it from the perspective of the community benefits, in terms specifically of job development and energy savings. Also, savings in terms of local dollars for our residents in Duluth and Northeast Minnesota. And then third, in this presentation, you'll hear kind of from the perspective of what a citizen or a customer might experience if they were to participate in this energy efficiency program in Duluth. Jody and Dean will do most of the talking as they are kind of the technical experts in this. Should we go to the next slide now? And then, so this kind of gives you an idea of the overall concepts of this program and in what it is we want to accomplish in terms of measurable goals. And we really want this to be a program that provides measurable results. And I say that again in terms of both energy savings and savings of local dollars for our, you know, residents, citizens of Duluth. And we want it to be a program that is creating long-term job growth. With that, I'll send it back to Jody, and when we get to Dean's slides, he can introduce himself in more depth.
Ms. Flick.
Thank you. When we started looking at how we could maximize energy savings in the community and also maximize the creation of local jobs, I think we came to the conclusion of many throughout the United States that if we were to focus on the biggest bang for the buck, we should be looking at what type of energy efficiency we can get for dollars that are actually invested. And our local utility, Minnesota Power, has been working, and I believe you may have seen a presentation on this previously, on an energy efficiency pyramid, which basically looks at what are those at the very base of the pyramid, the low-cost, no-cost measures that should be implemented, then moving up into those things that get a bit more expensive, have a longer payback, and then finally to kind of the top of the pyramid, those things that should only really be considered once the other work has been done. One of the reasons why we're talking about this in the community is the more we talk about energy efficiency, the more we hear from everybody, oh, solar on top of a building, or those miracle Amish stoves, or ground source heat pumps, or wind turbines. And really, we recognize as a community that if we want to look at energy efficiency as an economic development tool, we know that we're not generating that electricity or that energy in our community. When we have to pay for energy, we're sending those dollars out of town. If we were looking at trying to save as much of that money in our community, the first thing we should be doing is air sealing our buildings, dealing with the performance of those structures, and then also hand in hand, as you see at the bottom of the pyramid here, focusing on working and moving our residents to take action for those things that aren't just about a leaky house, but are about whether or not I turn on my lights, wash my clothes with hot or cold water, etc. So from that, we've basically broken this pyramid into 3 points of focus. The very first point is the community education and action, and that's where we get into the lower part of the pyramid, and then into the performance-based improvements for the homes, and only after those things have been dealt with, looking at demonstrating kind of the beyond the basics approach. We know in our community that 67% of the energy use we have is something that's under an individual's control when you look at the energy that goes into transportation, into our homes, and into food. And specifically in Duluth, as we begin to look at the performance-based improvements for housing, we know that about 45% of the energy is expended by buildings. And that in Duluth, if you look at the 2000 census, 50% of our buildings are more than 80 years old. We've got an extremely old housing stock, which means, in general, our housing stock is also much, much leakier. By air sealing and weatherization, they always talk about the low-hanging fruit, and this is it. It is very achievable in our housing stock to see a reduction of 20% to 30% of energy. And Minnesota Power has actually had a pilot study where they did advanced energy audits, home performance audits, and were able to look at how leaky our housing stock is and the potential. So those are based on that study.
Mr. Chair, could I ask a question on this?
Senator Senjum.
On the air sealing thing, and I haven't been here, there's some probably members around this table that have been here long enough to remember that there was a point in time, maybe in the 90s, when, and this had to do with the building codes, when we were rather aggressive about building codes and energy and sealing, and then we ran into indoor air quality problems. And so referencing that history, when we talk about air sealing houses now once again in the year 2009, as the case might be, are we going down that same path, or is there a difference between what we call air sealing with reference to this bill and air sealing with reference to what occurred with some of the building code issues in maybe the late 90s?
Yes.
I'm just kind of curious about that. In other words, do we do this and find ourselves in 5 or 6 years dealing with indoor air quality problems? Is there a difference in, when you use this term, is it different than what we knew previously?
It is based on the idea that we really are talking about performance based. We're talking about looking at building performance and building science. When we were dealing with air sealing in the past, when energy prices were high, et cetera, we were talking about just tightening the house, and not looking at the entire house as a system. And the idea that when we're dealing with auditors, when we're dealing with tightening those houses, we do need to have a high level of training so that we're not causing those indoor air quality problems is definitely something that we're focusing on. And it is that building science approach. And Dean, when he gets into his slides, will be able to give you a little bit more information about that. But you're right. We need to make sure that as we're doing this, as we're focusing on energy, we're also focusing on occupant health.
Thank you.
The third part of the program is the concept of above and beyond. Even if we're talking about making our houses 30% tighter or using 30% less energy, we do know as we move into the future that reducing our carbon footprint, for example, by 30%, reducing our energy use by 30% isn't going to be enough into the future. And so understanding that as a community we need to take these first steps, and there should be some opportunities to be demonstrating what those future steps need to be. On the community education and in action, again, focusing on, this is more of a community organizing strategy, focusing on those low-cost, no-cost measures. And that actually will help us identify, and I know that's a theme that had come up in earlier presentations, what those leakiest houses are. You know, we feel as a community, if we're putting together a program, we should be focusing on the leakiest houses and then also assisting getting those changes actually made to the houses. So we're talking about more of a community organizing strategy to look at the houses in our community and do some very simple assessment of them to know whether or not this house is one of our worst, one of our best, or if it's somewhere in between, so that we can target the program specifically to where our leakiest houses are. And we have been talking with CEE, who has a very similar program that they have piloted on neighborhood energy strategies and those lower and no-cost measures.
Madam Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify. And this is quite an honor for me to speak to you about energy. I've been passionate about it.
Mr. Talbot, if you'd just introduce yourself for the record, please.
Yes, I'm going to. Thank you. My name is Dean Talbot, and I work for Minnesota Power. I'm a residential SIP program manager, so I've been doing that the last 20 years. What my work entails, I work with basically all the residential programs, everything from energy auditing to ground source heat pumps to energy efficient lighting to even new construction and renewable energy programs. So we've got a whole variety of programs that we offer and that I work with. So what I'm going to do here is kind of talk about really the aspects of what this, the audit, the technical audit. And I want to get back to Senator Senjem's really great question that he asked about air tightness. And certainly one of my roles at Minnesota Power is managing a new construction program. We started that in 1990. Indoor air quality in new construction was a huge issue. And the state has taken great strides addressing the energy code to deal with ventilation. So we built a lot of homes in the mid-70s. Through the 80s, they got built fairly tight without adequate ventilation. So when we talk about air sealing, we are talking about the same concept, but the problems that we saw there, those were new homes that were built. You know, 2x6 walls, plastic vapor barrier. So it's a whole different issue than the 80 to 100 to 110-year-old home that we're dealing with. So really good question. And I think what we're dealing with are homes that have very high rates of air leakage. And you certainly don't want to get them too tight. There's a point where you may get to a house, and certainly the weatherization agencies, they go out to homes and they find they're already tight enough. It's not very often, but most times houses have excess air leakage. So just to clarify the program, it's more than just air sealing and weatherization. So what this is, it's going beyond the basic energy audit. It's a comprehensive audit. We are looking at electrical loads there, trying to reduce, you know, from Minnesota Power, that's our primary interest, to reduce electrical consumption in the household. And then also mechanical systems. So it is really a comprehensive approach to the house. And really the focus are on the impact of the improvements. It's all performance-based. So this is just a general graphic I use in a lot of my slideshows showing the air leakage points in a home. And oftentimes, and I should mention earlier, I started out in the weatherization world back in the early 80s, and I did a lot of blower doors, and we did a lot of homeowner education. And when you come in with your equipment, a lot of customers, they think, well, hook up the blower door, you've got your infrared camera. They'd expect the leakage to be all around the windows, and that's generally not where it is. It's all these hidden locations, a lot of times up in the attic. You can have fairly significant air movement, heat loss up into the attic, even if you have 12 or 16 inches of insulation up in there. So you could have a house that might be well insulated. It may not be well sealed. So this is just a picture of a blower door. I'm going to talk a little bit more about the training. There are more and more technicians that have the experience. I'm going to talk about training and capacity here, but this is just going back a slide, Jody. A blower door, in a nutshell, all you do is you depressurize the house, and you have the ability to measure the air leakage rate of the house. And as part of our pilot study, of course, we did this on every single house, and we have a very good database of what the average air leakage is of these old homes that we're talking about. And you can either measure that in air changes per hour or CF cubic feet per minute, but we know what that number is, and it's a very high air leakage number. So that's what this does. And then in addition, it's really helpful to have a thermal camera. The next picture shows this is an older camera. They make newer, smaller ones that are easy to use. The next picture actually shows the imaging. This is just looking at an exterior door into a garage. The next picture shows an infrared image. So the house is under a negative pressure. We're sucking cold air in from the outside. All those dark streaks you see, that's actually cold air infiltrating around the door trim, and it's actually cooling down the sheetrock. So this is what a technician would see. I don't know if you can... Anybody want to make a guess what that might be with an infrared camera?
The roof trim or the attic?
Attic hatch, very good. Now you are trained technicians. You're qualified to. That's exactly. You know, so this has 12 inches of insulation on top of this hatch. So you get the message here. It's about air sealing. This is a picture of a wall. You can see the upper left corner of a window. This is actually a newer house that the insulation was installed very poorly, and you can see those dark patterns on the wall. You can actually kind of make out the stud cavities. So I'm just showing you, these are just a few images of what a technician would see and what we're trying to find out in the homes.
Took those all off.
And so going into the performance-based improvements, what is really clear to point out, we've been offering free basic audits since the late 70s, Minnesota Power has. And it is, we need to make a distinction between what a basic audit is and advanced audit. So a basic audit, walk through, you know, maybe the homeowner gets some compact fluorescent bulbs, low flow shower heads, basic education. Over on the right there, what we're talking about is advanced auditing. And we're going to talk about, we've already had the discussion about the capacity of, do we have the capacity to ramp up and do this building diagnostics in Duluth and actually in the state? It's certainly an issue. Then we need to look at the skill level of the contractors. Many insulation contractors, there's actually only one in Duluth that owns a blower door. Most insulation contractors, they own a machine and they blow insulation. And there are really very few of them in the state are dealing anything with air sealing. And the state has done, the state energy office has done a very good job. They realize that contractors need more training. They need to understand building diagnostics and the building science in a house. So I'll talk a little bit about training. This is the question. Janet was addressing this a little bit earlier, and I'm going to add to it. There's a group of us, the partners you see. There are two utilities, Great River Energy and Minnesota Power, Mary Lou Chappell, who is here from the Minnesota Office of Energy Security, Jana Fleestrand from the Minnesota Green Communities, John Harrington from Greater Minnesota Housing Fund, Pat Heelman, from the University of Minnesota Cold Climate. We've got Kevin Brower from Center for Energy and Environment and Paul Morin from the Energy Conservatory and then Ed Von Toma from Building Knowledge. This is a group of people that have been put together, that have come together, and I'll spare you the details how we've ended up together, but we've addressed three key training modules that need to take place. And we probably didn't, you know, what we're talking about, this is the work we're talking about is beyond weatherization. We're not competing with weatherization agencies. These are really for households that don't meet income guidelines, let's say, so we're clear about that. So this training, we're in the process. There was actually a subcommittee meeting this afternoon on that first bullet. It's advanced auditor training. And I think what we've all heard today is the Dunwoody auditor training is a real basic level training. It doesn't prepare them to go out in the field and do blower door infrared. So this group is putting together curriculum. We're looking at train the trainer. We're looking at building capacity to actually do this advanced auditor training in the state. The goal is to have 4 to 5 training locations around the state and hopefully begin the training in April. The second training module is actually the insulation and air sealing. These are completely different skill sets, and this is where the contractors will be trained on insulation and air sealing. And then the third module is mechanical contractors. Combustion safety is extremely important here. And anybody who knows housing and energy, this is a really key area here to make sure we protect the health of the occupant. So those are the training efforts underway. And I guess, are you segueing into the funding part of it?
Ms. Slick?
In trying to put together a program that would work in a community and to build capacity to scale that up to do a number of houses a year, we looked at the need to work with the capacity of auditors as well as contractors. But then there is the need to have funding and make sure that there is adequate coordination in the community. So we've broken, as we've looked into that, the program design into two components. One is getting the actual audits done, and then the second part is the follow-up and actually doing the improvements. Minnesota Power, Comfort Systems, which is our gas utility, have been involved in a number of programs. Again, the advanced audit is something that has been available in the community, but there necessarily hasn't been follow-up in those households to actually getting the improvements done. And if we're talking about trying to extend construction jobs, look at actually saving the therms, then just knowing that my house is leaky isn't enough. We need to be able to follow up with action. And so the funding becomes the next component. On the audit size, aside, right now under the Conservation Improvement Program, Minnesota Power has been working internally and also working with Comfort Systems, the Duluth city-owned gas utility, to put together a program in which the cost of that audit would be shared one-third by the electric utility, one-third by the gas utility, and one-third by the homeowner. And as we've talked about program creation, we've also talked about what type of opportunities there would be available if we're working with individuals that might not qualify for AEOA, our weatherization program assistance, but would still be on the lower income side. The second area is really looking at how do we facilitate getting those improvements done, because that's where we save the therms and create the jobs. And so as part of that, we've begun looking at kind of what are the gaps and overlaps that exist in our community. We have AEOA working on the low-income side. We have Comfort Systems has a loan program, which is at 4.9%, but that's a program that has pretty much become a furnace replacement program. If somebody's furnace goes out, quick, can you help us out? Can we do a loan? And unfortunately, when we're reactive that way, instead of air sealing the house and then being able to replace with a smaller furnace, we end up not air sealing the house and putting another bigger unit in there. So there are other programs and organizations we've worked with, and like our other housing partners, the Housing and Redevelopment Authority, et cetera. We've looked at ways in which we can kind of leverage the existing programs and believe that one of the best ways that we can cover kind of where those gaps are is by creation of a revolving community energy fund. And as we further develop that program, we're looking at wanting to, again, focus those resources and what would be available in resources to households based on how leaky the house is or how much of an energy hog a particular structure is, and then also look at incomes. There are individuals that may have houses that aren't very leaky, and the few changes that they need to make are something that can just be borne by them, and it would make most sense to target the houses and incomes that need the most assistance.
Ms. Flick?
Yes.
Could you go over the mechanics a little bit of that energy fund, how that's how it's gotten started and how you work it?
We do not have this the Community Energy Fund set up yet. Comfort Systems does maintain a revolving loan fund on their side, and again, they're a city-owned utility. We would be looking at trying to work with the city to have that fund, and basically the structure that we've talked about is having the city as a fund manager, and then utilizing a third-party organization to coordinate the program. When we're looking at trying to put this together, what we feel is very important is on the energy efficiency side, there is a payback. And one of the biggest barriers is to come up with the first dollars to get the improvement done, because there's right now with credit markets, with where people are feeling the economy is at, as well as just the idea that a lot of people have, well, why should I improve my home if it's going to pay itself back after 8 years? I don't intend on being here that long. So if we're going to start addressing these structures, we need to deal with what those perceived barriers are. And so we believe that setting up a community energy fund assists with those barriers for the individual, and it's also a way of hopefully taking what could be stimulus dollars and not only creating those jobs and energy savings now, but because there is a payback on the energy side, creating longer-term sustainability. Because as we look at trying to set up training programs that for those that there's initial training programs so we can put people that already have the trade skills into these jobs. But if we're looking at trying to create career pathways beyond 18 months or 2 years when we start talking about somebody that may need to be trained over 6 months or over a year or over 2 years. We need to have a program and some options available more than 18 months or 2 years from now. And so we feel at the community level that if we can set up a program that not only gets dollars on the streets now, but has a payback mechanism, we can create some sustainability not only for those jobs, but tackle more than, say, 3% of our homes.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you. Just to follow up on that, so how do you, what's your plan for that? I mean, for how it will pay itself back, is this a loan program that homeowners would borrow the money from this fund to make the improvements and then pay it back? Or is there some other, and some grants for those who need or more needy? I mean, how does that work?
We're in the process of that design right now. We've put together a couple of different models that could work. And as we've talked with other communities throughout the states that have been approaching things this way, how that's set up kind of varies. One thing that we have talked about is in setting up that fund and setting up the program, a line has to be drawn as to what the payback period for the improvement would be. And, we've talked conceptually right now about 8 years, that if an improvement can pay itself back in energy savings over the course of 8 years, then that's something that would qualify. And that's an important distinction because some places have put together programs where what they're looking at is just the number of dollars and the number of houses, and then the owner can kind of select anything, to put in, and it becomes a window replacement program in a very leaky house. So we want this to be performance-based and, again, really focused on the ability to save those therms. And so we've looked at an 8-year scope, I guess, for those improvements, and then looking at those funds actually being paid back perhaps over 10 years. And so what would end up happening is there would be, in the energy savings, 80% going back to pay for the improvements and a 20% kind of in pocket to the household that's become involved in the program.
So, Mr. Senator Chair, Anderson. Some of us have had discussions about this concept a lot and trying to figure out how that could work. Is Minnesota Power going to be the utility that's, how do you arrange it so that you can pay off the loan with the energy savings? Is there sort of one check that the homeowner writes, or is that done through billing for the utility? Or
There's a couple of different models that we've explored. Comfort Systems right now has a program in which they don't have it set up right on the utility bill. They're actually sending two different envelopes in the mail, and they're looking at putting that together in the near future. So that is one potential way of doing it. The two that have been talked about is on a utility bill, and then the second one is as a fee on your property taxes. Programs in New York that have looked at this, they look at trying to overcome that hurdle of a very mobile society to say, well, I'm not going to be in my house, so why should I put all this money in not to receive the savings? And so they've looked at models in which it becomes like a street improvement thing that stays with the house. So you pay back 3 years of it, and you receive the benefit for 3 years, but the next owner pays for the next 7 years. Mm-hmm. There's also an ability or could be an ability to keep it tied to the meter. That's one of those hurdles that right now would involve you good people once we kind of determined which method seems to make the most sense in our community.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, one more follow-up, and you'll be seeing me again when you come to the Finance Committee, so okay. I'll be asking these questions, too. We can do it now or then, but if this money is, if we're giving you money from the stimulus bill to do this, that is intended to happen very fast, and I know it sounds like you've got a lot of plans ready to go, but the financing piece doesn't sound like you quite have it figured out yet, which path you're going to take, and how long would it take to get that up and running so that this could, you know, those dollars could be put to work right away. How long will it take you to get that figured out and implemented?
Ms. Slick.
Well, our focus once we understand kind of what the parameters and the rules are, is really going to kind of inform how we move forward with that particular portion of the design. Much like things happening at the national level and here, it's really important to try to utilize the pathways that already exist. And so with Comfort Systems already having a methodology in place, and again, with that being a city-owned utility, we're probably in a better position to utilize that pathway than, for example, if we were a city trying to partner with a regional utility.
Senator Prettner-Solon?
Well, actually, Ms. Schlick, I think, answered the question. Otherwise, we would have to quickly introduce a tax bill, I think. So we'll have a discussion after this meeting.
Okay. Senator Dibble, did you have a question?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Senator Anderson, actually, she and I have had a lot of these conversations, and so she asked a lot of questions that I was going to ask. But specifically, you know, I've been most attracted to, sorry, I'm doing the fine-grained questions here, but I'm not on the finance committee. And I think, Mr. Chair, you also have been interested in trying to tie the repayment for these things onto utility bill, and I hear third-hand utilities hate that idea, and I don't understand why, because of course we see in other sorts of you know, basic utility type services, specifically our telephone service, they're able to pick up you know, billing for other entities, and you know, this could be really tied into the SIB programs, and it would just make it really easy and really obvious for consumers, and that could stay with the house too. I mean, I think that's been one of the objections. So what have you discovered as you've looked around the country? Have other utilities managed to be able to tie the repayment to their utility bill?
Ms. Slick.
There are a couple of different models. When we actually had first started talking, one of the models that we had kind of started with is there's the Berkeley model, and that is not necessarily with utilities, but there an investment is able to be made in adding solar to roofs, and that is considered a community investment. In the town of Babylon, which is on Long Island, the way that they accomplished putting a program together like this actually involved them classifying carbon as a solid waste. And so they started a community energy fund out of reserves from their solid waste fund. And then what ends up happening is that ends up as an assessment on the property tax bill. And that's an assessment that stays with the house as opposed to being something that has to be paid off by the owner. In relation to utilities, there are kind of different partnerships that are being worked out. I've only really talked with the Center for Working Families in New York, which is looking at trying to put together a $5 billion statewide fund to do this. And their partnership with the utility, and I don't remember the exact kind of how they end it, but there is, as part of that, the idea that if you're not paying off your loan, with some extra safeguards, especially on the low-income side, but if you're not paying off your loan, the utility can turn your meter off.
I think we recognize that this particular component is the crucial part for sustainability.
You bet.
If we can't get this figured out, you know, then at 2 years, the spigot turns off. So we've been working on these ideas as well, and if you've got, you know, we should be continuing to communicate on those so we can share and trying to find out a way that what model's going to work. Mm-hmm. So,
Senator, may I add?
Mr. Talbot.
Thank you. Really good question about how the utilities would play into this for financing. And the thing to keep in mind, most of this energy savings from this program are going to be thermal upgrades, okay? Most of the households, that means a reduction in gas usage. We're strictly an electric utility. So in reality, there's a much greater interest for the gas utility in this case to meet these new 1.5% of energy sales target. there's much greater potential there. For our perspective from an electric utility, we really wouldn't have a lot to gain by having some financing program for a whole house. So I think that's the distinction. It depends on the type of fuel. An ideal situation, if it was Xcel that had both gas and electric, then it may be more likely. But I just want to make that clarification there for electric-only utilities.
Okay. Thank you. Well, I'll have you continue on. I think we're getting close to our...
Sure. We're just about at the end, and I appreciate the opportunity to present this. The one thing that we wanted to make sure is that we also talk to you about how this would work from the consumer part of view. We think that it's very important that we establish a one-stop shop, and so that if there are questions about energy, as we're working with agencies on the education and the community organizing at the very basic or bottom level of that pyramid, that those efforts are coordinated. So we're looking at creation of a community energy center in which we've got coordination of those activities. It would be that one place that you would call to get your performance audit taken care of, which would be that agency would be creating a list of approved auditors, and we've talked what those standards would be, and that's one reason why individuals from Duluth have gotten involved in the conversations about what kind of training has to be there. There would be then coordination of the work, and it would be this organization that would be paying the subcontractors upon successful completion of the work. So this would be the organization that would implement things on behalf of the energy fund and would be the one-stop shop for the community. Because, again, it's about getting over those barriers, and even as our own group, in our working group, we've talked about plugging in some numbers to the Department of Energy site just to get an energy yardstick on our own homes. And it's not a long and laborious process, but people are so busy these days, and there's so many other things in people's lives that it's hard to get people to move too far, too fast. And so the easier that we can make it from the consumer side, the better it can be on behalf of trying to get larger numbers of buildings taken care of in our community. And we do believe strongly in post-performance testing because, again, it needs to be about saving that energy and doing the work correctly. And it is amazing when you think that we've got, and again, we do construction. You've got insulation contractors that don't necessarily do air sealing, and it's about time we take our level of technical knowledge and bring it to a programmatic level so that we're doing things right. And then at this point, just talking about kind of those above and the beyond measures, not things that we're doing, although in conversations with the city of Duluth, they have been making more and more steps on the affordable housing side. Tony Cuneo can talk about that.
Before I turn it over to Tony, Senator Dibble would like to ask a question.
Councilmember, maybe touching on this, but my question is what do you envision for, kind of relates to the one-stop shop part, for letting the community know that this is available, that they have this.
Ms. Slick.
New resources, new
sure.
New opportunity.
There's actually, again, depending on the final partners that are involved, there's a number of different strategies that can be implemented. The Minnesota Center for Energy and the Environment has a proposal for lottery funds to actually expand what had been a pilot on neighborhood energy workshops and kind of community organizing around energy. They are working with six of the kind of southern metro or metro communities, and then Duluth would also be kind of their seventh outside or in the greater Minnesota area. And that is an opportunity to be doing community organizing. We've also been talking to other groups in Duluth. We're involved in the beginning stages of a Green Jobs Initiative over the course of 1 year to really look at what environmental indicators we want and what specific action steps we want in the community. And above and beyond our working group and those we've been talking to on the single-family housing side, that group is a much more expansive group. And utilizing community tools, we've got actually a faith community in Duluth that has been very active in sustainability. There's the Sustainable Twin Ports Initiative, which has been working on an early adopters project, and it's really kind of plugging in to groups that already exist. We haven't fully explored and expanded, but there's a lot of conversation about like youth programs and all of that, and we believe on the technical side that to try to ramp up, it does not at this point make sense to try to pull youth into the actual audit work, and probably only on a limited amount on like the air sealing and weatherization work, but a summer program to get out into the community to do the education, to work with CFLs and getting that initial rating on each of the houses so we know where our focus should be are definitely some opportunities that could fit very nicely with a youth program.
Senator Prentner-Solon.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, but the youth could be used for outreach. They could be outdoor knocking and letting people know about the project and providing information so that they're informed.
Okay. And did we want Mr. Cuneo to wrap us up here? Or?
Yep.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I'll be brief, and I'll just kind of follow up with a couple thoughts after listening. And I think the youth piece is important because I think we are talking long-term about including them in all aspects of this program. I think it's a balance of spending that money out quickly as we need to do first and finding ways to get them involved so that they can kind of find that path to be more involved in the auditing and the actual construction work in future years. And I think, you know, it's there are some questions left to be answered. Part of that has been it's just been impossible to understand what rules might come attached to the federal recovery money. And then, but we have been exploring the different models. So once those questions are answered, I think we will be able to kind of plug in the proper partners exceptionally quickly. Other than that, I'll just reiterate that this is a project that, you know, is performance-based. Is talking about kind of filling that gap around energy efficiency and money savings that the community action programs, you know, they have the income levels that they can only go to. And so we want to open this same opportunities up to the entire community. And when we kind of take that bottom rung of that pyramid, then we start to look at the above and beyond projects. When we do that bang for your buck early, the most efficient work, then we can start taking a look at, you know, the deeper level work, the solar panels, the kind of next level of energy efficiency. So other than that, thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you, all of you, for your testimony. What's encouraging is that as we're all talking about this, you know, we're finding out that we're all kind of moving in the same direction. We kind of recognize what the needs are. Some of these ideas, even though your identities are generated in Duluth area, we're talking about the same types of things. So there's we know that we're kind of moving in the same direction. That's a good thing. We keep this conversation going. We'll figure out the details. Senator Prentner-Solon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a very exciting integrated program, and it's one that's replicable around the state. I think, if nothing else, the training program is something that could be useful as we move forward with the stimulus package. I think the whole program is exciting, and I'd like to see us provide some support to it. But they do have a training model, I think, that could be useful as we move forward with weatherization, too. So, Mr. Chair, I would move that Senate File Number 1405 be recommended to pass and referred to Finance.
We have some questions from the members. Senator Dibble?
No, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to articulate support. This is a very, very exciting and compelling presentation. You've done tremendous work and are really wrapping a lot of the elements in that the stimulus package and, frankly, our renewable energy future and our energy efficiency future make possible. So thank you for this work. And you know, it sounds like you've got a ways to go yet, and I'm hoping we can get this thing ramped up to scale to serve Duluth and maybe replicate it in other places in time to qualify for the stimulus dollars, because we absolutely, you know, are under some pretty strict, compelling deadlines. Nothing clarifies the mind, though, like a deadline. So thank you for this.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Senator Bretner-Solden, thank you very much, and I appreciate the presentation that you made. I'm asking about this, and then another thing on the agenda tonight, and I'm sorry I'm being pulled between two committees. I'm being pulled over for another vote over here, so I need to ask a couple questions here about for both this and another one that's on the agenda. It seems to direct so I'm talking about the bill now. It seems to direct the Office of Energy Security must fund with federal stimulus dollars. So it's direct. This bill really is about directing that office about how to spend federal stimulus dollars.
It's a Senator Sharon. It's a small carve out, not all the stimulus dollars.
But there's not an appropriation number here.
No, I figured that it would need to go. We at the time that the bill was drafted, actually, we didn't know what the funds would be that would be available, and so it needs to go to finance. I wanted to show you the model to see if it was worth the funding, it was worth the support, and then we will have to prepare an amendment before when it goes to finance.
I guess my essential question is more about. Because another bill, also has a blank appropriation for federal stimulus funds. So my question really is about whether or not we want to establish a criteria by which the funds should be distributed by competition or how of their process, or if we are going to set up a system here where everybody's racing in to carve out money from the federal stimulus package, and if they're not in fast enough or quick enough, then we set up a system where people don't have an opportunity to compete for these dollars. That's what I'm reacting to here. I'd like to talk about that a bit before I go over and vote on another.
Senator Bretner-Solden.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, what we're looking at is policy right now, whether this is a reasonable policy for us to be supporting and passing on to the Finance Committee. I think that probably Senator Anderson can respond to this better. She will set up criteria, I imagine, in her division.
Senator Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Bretner-Solden, that's right. I think, and Senator Sharon, I don't really envision. We're going to take all the proposals that come forward and put together a bill that lays out how some of the money should be spent, working with the Office of Energy Security. There's three different big pots of money. You know, one of them is block grants that are going to go to some cities, and that's one possibility for funding. And then there's the weatherization dollars. And then there's sort of some undesignated dollars. So we have to figure out which programs fit best into which pots of money. But I certainly intend to make sure we have a bill, that our spending of these dollars is fair and statewide, and that we're not just focusing on one or two cities around the state. And I don't think you need to worry so much about your city getting in line quick with a proposal, because there's a lot of mechanisms for making sure that the work that's done with these dollars is done statewide. So we have to, that's what the Finance Committee will be talking about, how to make sure that we do this in the best possible way to benefit as much of the state as possible.
Well, just to make sure that I'm
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Sorry, Chair Dahl. There is this money, three pots of money that sort of gets distributed in certain ways. Weatherization is pretty clear about what that's going to be focused on. But if these move through and go to finance, are we saying that of those pots of money, we want to preempt the we want to define that these in fact will be funded, and that others may come along and be funded?
No.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, no, because there's more bills asking for more money than there is money. So we're going to have to prioritize in the Finance Committee, number one. Number two, I would expect if we like this model, maybe what we'll do And this is just amazing. I don't know what we're going to do yet, but one approach would be to set up a pot of money that could be used for this type of program, but allow different communities around the state to compete for it. That's maybe one approach. It's but I don't quite know the answer to that. But.
And then one Senator final Sharon. Question. Senator Anderson, if I may direct this to Senator Anderson, thank you.
We have to go vote.
I know we have to go over to this other committee vote. Does that mean, are you saying to me, for my information, that for the federal stimulus money, that there will have to be a bill introduced in order to...
I can answer that, Mr. Chair.
Does a bill have to be introduced in order for...
A bill, Senator Sharon, a bill has been introduced. I mean, we passed a bill out of this committee a week ago. That is the basis for building that bill.
But I mean,
Senator Sharon.
Furthermore than, thank you, furthermore than, do there have to be these kinds of bills that
yes.
Articulate how that will be appropriated within that framework?
Well,
Senator
Sharon, we've been asking for the past 2 months for these bills to come forward with ideas of how people would like to utilize the stimulus funds. So, yes, I am assuming so.
So it's not possible for this money to be set up a series of ways in which this could be expended and then allow the commissioner or the would be the Office of Energy Security to distribute them based on competitive grants for them. So requests from
Senator Prentner-Solon.
Mr. Chair, the Office of the OES will distribute them on competitive grants if we don't give them more direction. And these are attempts to give them more direction.
Yep. Okay.
Well, excuse me.
Senator Prentner.
There's more to that. The governor's office will provide us with their plan for how they intend to use the stimulus money. We have a very brief period to respond once the governor gives us that plan. And so this is in an effort to get prepared and ahead of that game. There's still plenty of time, though, to continue to form that.
Senator Prentner-Solon, I had two questions on the bill. One is just, I mean, maybe one of the testifiers can talk about it. It's just deep energy retrofits. What can you give me a little more clarification of what a deep energy retrofit is?
Sure.
Anyone?
A deep energy retrofit is looking at, instead of doing something where you're just changing out some windows and you're dealing with the air sealing and weatherization, deep energy retrofit is actually trying to modify that structure so that instead of using 30% less energy, you're at 70 to 80 to 90% less energy.
So we're doing insulation, we're putting in a high-efficiency furnace, those kind of things?
It's actually above and beyond that. Instead of just trying to take on an older house, a 2x4 wall, and bumping it out to 2x6, you may be looking at actually building a second interior wall or putting considerable amount of foam on the exterior as opposed to just like a one-inch application. Looking at passive solar as part of that retrofit, and then also looking at probably triple-pane windows. I work, again, with the Northern Communities Land Trust, which is a permanent affordable group. So when we're working on a house, we have to look at that house and those resources, not only helping the first family, but that helps the third family and the fifth family. So as an example, when we're looking at where we need to be for carbon in 2025 and 2050, and we know on our affordable housing, we're looking at that house serving a family for 100 years. We need to get to that point above and beyond. And so one of the most natural places to do that is where we continue to put our resources, which is in the affordable housing.
Sure.
Again, this program is trying to focus on those lower steps first.
I appreciate that. And Senator Prentner-Solon, I guess in the you say there's the program must include four elements, and in these three and four I mean, number three seems to be this. It is beyond the basics. It's beyond the scope, maybe, of what we're talking about doing with this weatherization money and this stimulus package. It's folks that, you know, can afford to put more money into their homes after the fact, and being a component in here. I don't know if that's something. Is that anyone that would be requesting these dollars through this initiative here in this bill would have to have that component as a part of their program to qualify for the dollars?
That's right. Mr. Chair, that's right.
Okay. And then the finally, number four, then, the plan to have a funding program. I mean, right now there's a plan there, but it's only kind of halfway there. It's not really – it's an idea. Mm-hmm. I mean, and a plan to me is something where you could actually implement, may have something you can actually do, you know, have a sustainable program. We're not there. So how articulated does that plan have to be, you know, to qualify as well? That's my other concern is that can any organization come forward and say, well, I have an idea of how I would do this, even if it's not going to happen, and be able to qualify for these dollars? Or, you know, how far do we have to go with that part of it?
Mr. Chair, well, that's a decision that will have to be made when it gets to the decision process. But the funds have to be expended by September 30th of 2010. So it has to be something that is able to meet that criteria.
Senator Pretner, so I'm thinking this plan to recycle program funds would be something where you set up a program to begin with that's maybe some sort of a revolving loan fund like the community energy program. So there's a sustainability part of that. That's not going to be spent funds but applied to a program. I mean, I'm really interested in this idea and how we would achieve this, but, you know, in putting these monies forward, maybe there's other programs around the state that could qualify for this, and yet, you know, are they going to have this plan set up? How far do we, like I say, since we're in the policy part of this, how far do we have to have this articulated before it moves forward? Is it finance going to decide, you know, the committee decide how that plan is going to be, or is it something that just comes forward from the groups, they decide and establish that at that point, or do we have to put the parameters in place?
Mr. Chair, I really see this again as a placeholder. I think it needs some fleshing out because we didn't know, we still haven't gotten the rules on the stimulus package. We don't know exactly what needs to be there. But I'm assuming that if we had a program like this, that the first cycle of dollars would have to be expended before September 30th of 2010 and before they could start recycling. So this doesn't necessarily have to stay in here. But for right now, it describes the model I'm presenting to you.
Okay. Mr. Fuller.
Mr. Chairman, I conversed with Ms. Streff, and it's possible that the money will be considered spent. This is just a point of information when it's granted out at the first level to the state, to the city. So it may not necessarily have to be spent on the final project.
Mm. Okay. All right, and then I'd give them some time to develop these programs, too, then as they're going, it's maybe this revolving loan fund or whatever.
And I assume a plan, I mean, the department will look at, and words are given their common understanding in bills, so they would have to have a plan, you know, something that they show them that's going to be operational. So it's more of a, you know, it's a common sense understanding that you will have to have something. It doesn't have to be, you know, operational at that second, but right. Something that will be operational when you receive the money.
Thank you for that clarification. Well, are there
so
any
Mr.
other
Chair,
questions?
Mr. Chair, I renewed my motion.
And I'll just open it up to the floor. If there's anyone else that wants to say anything at this point, right then, well, then on that motion to Senator Pretner-Solon, I'd like to recommend Senate File 1405 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. As Senator Stump's bill will be next.
Somebody has to bring it to me. I don't have those things. Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Listening to the previous discussion, I want to keep it quite short.
I'm sure. We'd appreciate it.
What Senate File 961 does is look at the opportunity that you've just been discussing for some time, but in just a little bit different way. And we want to present or put forward the idea that we have a number of manufacturers in the state of window manufacturers in the state of Minnesota, but also how important windows are in the overall energy efficiency of our buildings, both public and private. And so what this tries to lay out is a way to try to identify those facilities that can maximize better windows, more efficient windows, and then both at the public level and at the private residential level, and then identify those savings, basically, that can be long-term savings for the state and local governments, as well as for individuals whose residences. What I'd like to do is to ask, we have representatives from both Marvin Windows and from Anderson Windows, and turn it over to Susan Rader, who some of you might remember, Mike Wilhelmy, who has worked in my office for quite a number of years. This is Susan, they're a team. So welcome, Susan.
Thank you, Senator.
Ms. Rader.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank you for letting us be here today.
Absolutely. I was wondering why Mike was in the room.
I kept my maiden name, and I think that confuses everybody regularly. Today I'm here on behalf of Anderson Windows, along with my friend Steve Turek from Marvin Windows, and we appreciate the opportunity to lend the voice of business and manufacturers in the state to this very important discussion. I would just say that we are extremely encouraged by the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, particularly because of the energy efficiency message, that common sustainability thread that runs through it. Our businesses were founded on that theory. Both of us are over 100 years old, manufacturing here in the beautiful state of Minnesota. And we just think that we certainly can contribute to the conversation as we look for new and innovative ways to improve existing buildings and new construction, all of those things as they come down the pike. One of the things I was able to do in working with the Center for Energy and the Environment, who I know is advising the state on some of these opportunities that are in front of us, was put some real manufacturing numbers to them. And I think that that can help you as you make your decisions along the way. One of the numbers that they came out with was that since 1990, there's about 1.7 million units of housing in the state that have been built, and prior to 1976, there's an additional 1.4 million. And both of those numbers are important because both of them, in many ways, would be improved by having new windows installed in those homes, as well as commercial buildings. And if you want to look at real numbers for that, if you replace the windows in 1% of the 1.7 million homes in the state built prior to 1990, that would be 17,000. Clearly, that would be 270,000 windows. So you're estimating 16 windows per opening. And manufacturers like Anderson and Marvin could create 220 new jobs in the state of Minnesota to replace 1% of the windows of that housing stock. And those are real jobs, high-paying jobs. We both pay very good wages to our employees and great benefit package and long-term careers for them. And so, you know, that's a real wonderful number that you can kind of sink your teeth into when you look at what we're talking about with this project. But it doesn't just stop at manufacturing the windows. Someone has to install them, clearly. And so we extrapolated that number out over three-person crews installing those windows across the state. And that would be an additional 1,062 jobs, new jobs, that would be added in our state. And Minnesota, I think, has a unique opportunity to lead. As we've heard from speakers prior to me, there are many ways we've led the country in a lot of innovative ways. I think it would be wonderful with the stimulus money on the spirit in which it was given around weatherization, energy efficiency, if we could use that model and share this with other states. Turn it over to Steve in case he has any additional things to add.
Thank you, Susan. Madam Chairman.
Mr. Turek.
Committee members, it's a pleasure to be here to speak in support of Senator Stubbs' bill. I'm here to speak on behalf of Marvin Windows and Doors. I'm the Senior Vice President and General Counsel. But I would also say that I am also the chairman of the board of directors of the Window and Door Manufacturer Association, which is the national trade association representing more than 130 manufacturers of windows, doors, and skylights. Some of our industry's most prominent brands, including Anderson and Marvin, are members, but there are others. And I would simply point out that all of these manufacturers make very energy-efficient products that are sold, distributed, and installed in this state. So that while, like Anderson, Marvin is proud of its heritage as a good citizen of this state, someone that provides good jobs and shares its profits with its employees, in service of energy efficiency, jobs are created at multiple levels. Not only the manufacturing, which is our principal concern, but also at distribution and installation and sales. The only additional point that I would make to Susan's comments would be to emphasize the fact that it's widely accepted that buildings are responsible for about half of all U.S. energy consumption and carbon dioxide emissions annually. The American Institute of Architects has estimated that building operations alone, heating, cooling, and lighting, account for 43% of the total U.S. carbon dioxide emissions and 76% of total U.S. energy consumption. It's widely accepted that high-performance windows can greatly reduce energy consumption and heating and cooling costs. With the new technologies that are available at Marvin and Anderson, as well as other companies, it's now possible to have lower heat loss, less air leakage, and warmer window surfaces that improve comfort and minimize condensation. The Federal Energy Management Program for the Department of Energy estimates that a typical home loses more than 25% of its heat through windows. In older homes, poor windows account for even more than that. So as I've listened today to many of the presentations about weatherization, one thing that strikes me is funding is available to insulate a home. But if you don't have energy-efficient windows in that home, you've made a piece of Swiss cheese. The energy loss just gets sucked right out through the windows. So I think that a significant part of any solution to energy efficiency is providing opportunities and funding to install the most energy-efficient windows that are available today, taking advantage of the new technologies that we've developed. The front lines of energy efficiency and lowering greenhouse gas emissions is the exterior envelope of the building. That's where your heat loss generates. And if you can't shore up your envelope, you could put the most efficient furnace in a building, and all you're doing is losing energy more efficiently. So I think that windows are a part of the solution. I'm not here to say that they are the only thing by any means. One final thing I would just like to bring to your attention is that yesterday Energy Star released its new proposed regulations. And using the NFRC software, the most current version, I ran a calculation. I shouldn't say I did it. Someone who knew how to do it did it for me. And the calculation is using the new Energy Star standard that was just released yesterday. It's estimated that a home in Minneapolis of 3,000 square feet, replacing single-pane clear glass, the old-style windows, with the current version of Energy Star, would save 37 to 43% of source energy in heating and cooling costs and reduce carbon emissions by 11,000 to 13,000 pounds. So that in terms of creating a win-win, to create jobs, to create energy efficiency, energy-efficient windows, doors, and skylights are an important part of the solution to that problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I used to sell windows about 20 years ago, and yeah, I know that they're energy efficient. I think the question isn't so much of if they're energy efficient, but it's, again, that biggest bang for their buck. And I think most houses, even 20 years ago, I would sell a house full of windows was, you know, a $10,000 project. And we're talking about maxing out even with this at $6,500 for projects. You know, I don't know that windows, I think that's the whole idea, is we've been getting information from the regulations on the federal stimulus money, and I don't know how much you're wanting to use that on this project or this idea, but that windows in general are not going to qualify as a part of that program. And I don't know if we can supersede that or anything with this type of bill, but in general, if we wanted to get the actual energy savings we're seeking with the dollars we have available, the windows will probably be, in general, be the last place that we'd be putting that money at this point. And not that the idea isn't a good one, and I agree that you need they're a good investment, but overall, with the money we have to spend, we're running into some issues there. I don't think we'll be able to do that. Is this, Senator Stumpf, is this what you want to do, is use federal stimulus dollars to direct that towards using it for energy-efficient windows?
Senator Stumpf.
Madam Chair and Senator, I think there's actually a couple parts. One of them is relating to the public buildings. And there, obviously, I think we have a little more expanded opportunity. We just passed or will be passing a $360-some million bonding bill, which a good share of that will go into the retrofitting and maintenance of our public buildings. And so I think the that would not be necessarily the stimulus money, but I think what we're trying to do is to figure out how all of the parts come to bear on the energy plan that comes out that your committee and Senator Anderson's committee. How can we be a part of that plan in terms of making long-term savings and more efficient energy efficient buildings, and windows is definitely a big part of that. But I don't know exactly how the stimulus can be used, especially in the private residence, but definitely we'd like to be part of the discussion on that.
And Senator Dahl and Senator Stumpf, too, these aren't necessarily weatherization funds, but the state energy program funds. And remember that this isn't just, weatherization is very important, but it's also a jobs program. It's that the stimulus dollars are about creating more jobs, too, so.
Madam Chair, I don't know, because I've talked to the Office of Energy Security a few times on the money that's coming in, just weatherization in general. I understand the jobs part, but I keep getting the message that windows are way down on the priority list and that generally there's no funding for windows no matter what. So,
well, we have 13 times the money this year.
That'd be fine with me if they spend it there.
Okay. Is there a motion?
Oh, I would move this bill to finance.
For finance committees. Any discussion on the motion? Senator Olsen moves that Senate File 961 be recommended to pass and re-referred to finance. All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Thank you.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you.
Okay, great.
I know. It's really warm, too. Someone will come around. Madam Chair, we do have some handouts we'd love to have distributed, please.
The page is coming.
Great, thank you. Madam Chair, shall I begin?
You may.
Thank you. Senate File 996 is another request from federal economic recovery dollars, and it's an energy efficiency program for commercial properties. And I want to start out by saying that one of the amendments I want to make is to delete, I haven't told the St. Paul Port Authority yet, but I think I should delete St. Paul from the title, because actually this program we're proposing would be run by the St. Paul Port Authority, but it would serve half the state of Minnesota, and it would serve all of XL's service territory. So I want to be really clear about this, that this is a very broad program. This is a really innovative idea, and I want to I'll try to be very brief. I know it's late. Everyone's been here a long time. I just want to remind you, go back 2 years. We had a lot of discussion in this committee and in my division about the Rock 10 plant in St. Paul and the need they had for an alternative new source of energy and the need to save those 475 good jobs. And the legislature stepped forward with some dollars and some support for that process. And it's been an incredible success for our community, for that business, for the city, and for that workforce. And one of the great things that came out of that process was some very intensive energy audits that were done of Rock 10. I'm probably stealing all your testimony. Sorry. What they did was, with help from some state funds, is determine how much energy savings this plant could accomplish, more than they had ever dreamed was possible, for very effective, cost-effective costs. And I think that's kind of what inspired this program for the Port Authority. And what they are proposing, the St. Paul Port Authority, is to offer a financing program to be available for commercial properties, as I said, all through XL service territory, which is about one half the state of Minnesota. And it would be called the Trillion BTU program. And the theory behind that number is that they believe that with an investment of dollars and the plan that they have to use energy savings to pay for cost-effective energy improvements in business and commercial buildings, they could save about a trillion BTU, which is about half the energy consumed every year in downtown St. Paul. So it's a nice round number, a really big number, something you can kind of get your hands around, and it's a really ambitious goal. So that's what this bill is about. I'll try to just in summary, it allows the Port Authority to run this program, but allows businesses all around that territory to be eligible, and would require the port to submit a plan to the Commissioner of Commerce to review and approve before this would move forward. I'm going to let the good people from the St. Paul Port Authority tell you a little bit more detail about this or answer questions that we have. I've got Lori Lauder here and Pete Klein, who really shepherded the Rock 10 process through. Lori is the Director of Business and Intergovernmental Affairs for the St. Paul Port Authority, and Pete Klein is the Vice President of Finance. So I'll let them make a few comments, and then we'll take questions.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Ms. Lauder.
My name is Lori Lauder. I'd like to point to you, point out to you one of the three handouts you got, the one that says St. Paul Port Authority on the top. And I'm going to be greatly abbreviated in my comments in the interest of time. I wanted to tell you a little bit about the Port Authority. We're an economic development agency, about 77 years old, very customer-oriented to our business customers. Our main mission is to add to the tax base, to cause the creation and retention of good jobs at good wages, and to spur business growth. I think you can see on your outline some of the key areas of economic development that we undertake. We're known nationally and internationally for our brownfields efforts. You can see some of the outcomes there in terms of production as far as some of the numerics since 1995, over 155 acres redeveloped, spinning off about $5.4 million in annual property taxes. There are a lot of other efforts that we undertake, financing and customized job training and working to manage the river. And lately we are working on the 3M campus redevelopment on the east side. We have done quite a few energy conservation efforts, and I think you can read the rest yourself. Just wanted to give you a brief introduction of the Port Authority. I'm going to turn it over to Pete Klein to go through the Trillion BTU program. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Mr. Klein will go next.
Mr. Klein.
Madam Chair, Senators, my name is Peter Klein, Vice President of Finance for the Port Authority, and I'd like to go through four specific areas. One is the goals of the Trillion BTU program, some quick background, how we see it working, and then some expected results. And the goals are to improve the economic competitiveness of our business community by saving their energy costs and making them more capable of retaining and creating jobs. We also expect to be able to expand the existing conservation energy industry and really create a national center of expertise here in Minnesota. We expect to reduce fossil fuels greatly and the resulting pollutants and greenhouse gas emissions. And we also hope to help utilities reach their energy-saving goals. As Senator Anderson described, this program really was derived from the Rock 10 process. And what we found at Rock 10 was the St. Paul controller put in his wish list of capital projects, and the New York controller put in her wish list. And projects with six-month paybacks probably got funded, and one-year paybacks may have gotten funded, but much more than one-year paybacks just were not getting funded. And significant number of energy conservation projects have a payback of 1 to 5 years. So we developed this program to make funds available to businesses to invest in those energy conservation projects. The way that we see this working is we would develop a revolving loan fund that we would make these funds available. But the program really is something much more than a revolving loan fund. It really is leveraging the conservation and improvement program funds and really helping businesses become more comfortable with the investment in energy conservation projects. The idea then is to have these funds available. The program would pay for 100% of energy audits and probably three-fourths of the engineering studies. We want businesses to have a buy-in in this process, and so we would request that they would pay 25% of the engineering studies. And then we would make these funds available for the proposals that come out of the engineering studies. And as part of that, then conservation improvement funds would also be utilized as a rebate for those costs. We feel that a $24 million new program would be able to leverage about $8 million of conservation improvement program, investment program funds. And that's where we think on a conservative basis that we would be able to save 1 trillion BTUs annually. And the results are going to be our businesses will be more competitive. We will create a significant number of hundreds of very good paying jobs in the energy conservation industry. And the reduction in emissions is going to be significant. We also think that these funds, once they roll over to the next businesses, within a decade, we can probably at least double, if not triple, the effect of these program funds. We have significant support from the business community. Excel has been extremely supportive of this program. From the environmental community, we work directly with Center for the Energy and the Environment and various government agencies, including OES and other areas. And labor has also been very supportive. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions or comments?
Madam Chair, Mr. Fuller has an A1 amendment that's just some technical suggestions. I think this is John Fuller. And I think they're good suggestions, so I'd like to offer that. It's really just some clarifying language. This thing is blowing this weird hot air right in my face. Making me cough. Yeah, it's going to cool it. Just turn it off.
I'll just do these.
Uh-oh. It's fine.
A little antsy.
It's like this hot air blowing.
Senator Anderson, do you have a copy of the amendment?
I do have the amendment.
Okay, do you wish to speak to, do you want to introduce or offer the amendment then?
Yeah, I would treat this as an author's amendment. I think it just clarifies some of the language. It's really just technical.
Okay, does everybody have a copy? On the A1 amendment then, all those in favor, Senator Dibble, do you have a copy? Oh, I'm sorry. On the A1 amendment, which is an author's amendment, all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I think what's really unique about this is that, first of all, the Port Authority has a lot of experience doing this now, and so they're in a good position to implement this program and offer it to businesses. But it's really, it'll have criteria based on energy savings, but also on identifying businesses that not only need energy efficiency improvements, but need competitive improvements in their bottom line so that we can make sure that we're retaining or creating as many jobs as possible from the businesses that are selected, as was the case with Rock 10. It really made a big difference in that company's ability to survive in St. Paul. And so it will create a lot of jobs as well as a lot of energy savings, and then will stimulate a great deal of job activity also in the services that are contracted for to do the energy work. So I think it's a really great all-around package.
Senator Anderson, I had a chance to visit with Ms. Lauder, and I got very, very excited about the project and started to think about how I could get my own Port Authority and utility involved in a similar type of project. And I see this as one of those initiatives that are really important to doing something in the commercial and industrial area. And I appreciate you bringing this legislation forward.
Thank you.
And any questions? Senator Anderson, would you like to move your bill?
Sure. Madam Chair, if there's no other questions, I'll move that Senate File 996 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Thank you. Discussion? Then on Senator Anderson's motion, all those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
Thank you. Before anybody leaves, I committed a grievous error. And there was somebody here to speak to the previous bill, Senator Stump's bill, from the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota, Bonnie McDonald, Executive Director. I think she has left. She did leave a letter, though, and I'm hoping that she will take some time to read that. Is she coming back? No. Okay. I'm hoping you'll take some time to read that and review that. Oh, I apologize. Senator Dibble.
Oh, Madam Chair, I just wanted to say I knew if we waited long enough, energy efficiency would become exciting and sexy. So
that's right.
We'll have to tell. We're going to have to tell Senator Chaudhry about that.
Well, Madam Chair, I should point out that I was working on energy efficiency before you were even elected. So not to say that to show you up. The point is, it took a long time for that to happen, for it to be cool and popular. So thank you for your work.
You led the way.
Well, we've all done our parts, and it's exciting that everyone's talking about it now.
Okay. Well, that brings us to the end of our agenda. We do have a couple of bills on Tuesday. One of them is a fairly emotional and controversial bill, and I'm hoping that people will be here to give it your attention. So.
What bill is that?
It's Senator Betzold's bill.
Oh, yeah. Got it.
Okay.
That one.
Meeting adjourned.
Thank you.